can be fired with accuracy up to an amazing distance. Some of the guns that incorporated the server technology were revealed by Senator Church during the CIA assassination studies in Congress, and they had a looked like a German Luger with a rifle scope on it that would fire these things accurately with the scope to the length of a football field. So there's no problem with aiming them or getting them to do the job. And I have to assume that that Luger was the expendable technology, and I got better, or they wouldn't show it to us on TV. They can shoot you from a satellite, they don't have to worry about a gun barrel. But not with a 22, of course, but with other types of energy and heat generating stuff they can send out by satellite. And if they can knock an ICBM missile traveling through outer space out of the sky, I'm sure they can catch you on the street. So once they get Star Wars in place, the cities are the first target, I think. They can start firestorms and other things. But this guy made such a little wound with this disc, when they often contain poison and might have, in Reagan's case, that later led to cancer, but also can just be used. I think the idea was to penetrate the heart, but it deflected on the seventh rib and went into the lung and missed the aorta by about a quarter of an inch. They couldn't find a bullet. The nurses couldn't find a bullet wound. Now, this is GWU Hospital emergency room in D.C. They've seen bullet wounds, believe me. They didn't know what was wrong. They thought he was having a heart attack. Finally, when they got all his clothes cut off, the nurse saw what she described, and I read the medical magazines about this, and she said it was a little razor slit about an inch long with some black blood coming out of it, a little line of blood. And then she thought, well, you know, maybe he's been hit with something. But that isn't what a 22 or a 38 hole would look like. And then they went in and they couldn't find it, and they almost closed him up. They did three different x-rays to find the bullet. And then the doctor, the last time, just before closing, got the thing in his hand and his lung tissue and pulled it out, and he described it in the medical magazine as round, flat as a dime, round as a dime, about that size, and flat, razor edge. And then he hands it to the FBI that's waiting patiently. And it goes the way of all good bullets. Back into the history bin. So we don't hear about that bullet anymore. We hear about these 22 exploding shells and ricochet shots. Must have hit the back of the car and gone between the door for the car and gotten into Reagan on his way in. Because otherwise, how do you explain the wound described by Dr. O'Donnell that night at the press conference as a 45-degree downward, back to front, left to right wound? When I have Reagan here and Hinckley down about where you are, how are you going to get me from back there? So, you know, it just didn't fit. So then you got to bend Reagan over like this. Come back in from the other side of the car or something. I mean, you know, it's almost as impossible as the magic bullet in the Kennedy assassination, but these are minor details when you're killing a president. They did not expect him to survive. They got into the car without even police escort, and they yelled, "Rawhide is okay." Rawhide being his code name at the time. "Rawhide is okay." Oops, gigs up. So next, plan B, and Brady at that point is lying on the ground bleeding. And there is an early report that Brady is dead. Then there's a report that Reagan is shot. Then that Brady's shot, or not dead, or Reagan's not dead, or Reagan's dead. And it went back and forth like that for a while. The press couldn't seem to get it straight. And I'm turning on everything I can turn on, radio and TV, you know, the minute I hear it, because I know you're going to get the only news in the first few minutes. And the situation is somebody comes into GWU Hospital on a stretcher. Secret Service all around. And they come in a few minutes before and they clear out the emergency room. And they bring this guy through on a stretcher. So everybody assumes it's Reagan, he's hit, maybe he's dead, and he's going into surgery. But in fact, having looked at the case very closely, I now realize that that was Brady. Brady beat Reagan to the hospital. Brady, who took 3 more minutes to even get an ambulance near him, got to GWU before Reagan did. And then book that McCarthy writes about protecting the president that day, he says that they got in the car and they said they were going to take him to the nearest hospital, that's what you got to do. And so they went up T Street to Connecticut, and they said into the thing, "We're going right. We're going to," and then he says another code word, does put it in there, he says it means the White House. And if you go right on Connecticut Avenue, T Street, Washington, D.C., you're heading north, away from the White House, and up to another place in Maryland where the body of John Kennedy got taken, called Bethesda Naval Hospital, so that the United States Navy intelligence can finish the job of Mr. Reagan. In fact, Secret Service agents argued with hospital staff at GW all night until 6 in the morning. They finally gave up trying to move him up to Bethesda. They wanted to do the killing and the autopsy up there where they could control it. They didn't want him down in a public hospital. But a huge fight broke out between the Reagan loyalists and the Bush loyalists in the Situation Room in that hour at the command and control module, which is the communication module in the White House where all the nuclear and crisis commands sat. Helena von Baum, Reagan's appointment secretary and Otto von Bolschwing's employee. And the fight ensued to the point that a deal was made to let Reagan live as long as he got out of the way. Haig emerged, shaken, Bush's man, and said, "Gentlemen, I am in charge here until the vice president returns." Bush was flying out of Dallas on Air Force One. And so the transition of power, I believe, happened at that point. Hinckley was an easy enough patsy to set up and blame the murder on. Reagan managed to survive, but then from then on, he basically went out to Camp David, watched old movies with Nancy, waved at the press, you know, "Oh, I'm the president, wants to see my boots." The Contragate scandal then came in, created, I believe, by Bush. Oliver North is Bush's boy, and when you look at the testimony of North concerning this scandal, there's a point at which George Bush calls Oliver North at a hotel room, and he describes this call. He says, "I picked up the phone and I jumped to attention for the president." Kissinger and Kramer and Haig and Bush and Scowcroft and Brzezinski and North is the team that moves in this scandal. North is both CIA and DIA, National Security Council link. And he does several jobs for Bush, I believe. One being Operation Eagle Claw, the sabotage of a rescue attempt on the hostages in Iran that was never meant to rescue them. A covert operation handed over to Carter without his knowledge of what was up, run by Operation Yellow Fruit and the Independent Support Agency and the Delta Force and the secret counterterrorism teams that were created under Bush and all the Bush operatives. The Navy Task Force 59 under North. This was not a rescue mission. It was 800 miles from Tehran on a desert road near the Afghan border. It was a switch, I believe, of guns for drugs. You don't need five C-130 planes to refuel eight Huey helicopters. These choppers were defective. They were taken up out of the barrels of the Independence at sea, just to make sure the sand shields were pulled off the engine covers so that they would crash in the incident. And these Hueys, at best, on a full tank, will go 600 miles. I looked them up in Janes. So you've got to refuel twice, once on the way in to take over Iran with eight helicopters, and then once on the way out. Well, once we lost the three shot, I mean, even Americans can't take Tehran with just five Hueys. I've almost had them by the tail. This was run by Mr. Secord, among others, and it effectively embarrassed Carter. I think that North was part of similar sort of guns for drugs operations. This was I think Afghanistan opium, you know, the Pakistani opium, Afghanistan opium in exchange for guns for the rebels there, part of what this BCCI network was set up to finance. These guns for drugs covert operations have a worldwide network, drugs and terrorism, not, I'm talking about the real terrorism, not the pop gun guy on the airplane, but the death squads and the state terror that Bush presides over. Tremendous drug profits, they set up banks and organizations to cover it, and these scandals are just now breaking. And I think in addition to that, North was responsible for the sabotage of the Hassenfuss plane. Mr. Rodriguez was the first one to get knowledge that the plane was down and called Bush. They were done with the Contras, I believe, at that point, going on to the next level of wedging the phony liberal, Mrs. Chamorro, in like they did with Mrs. Aquino in the Philippines. They created the Contragate scandal to show Congress who was in charge. North rehearsed his patriotic talk, and they asked the stupid questions, and the scandal helped to drive Reagan out, not Bush, point the finger at him. I think that Oliver North was also instrumental in the sabotage of the 007, the KAL flight. When he came into the National Security Council, he was put in charge of the positioning of all spy satellites around the world, Oliver North. The Soviets at that point were running a very important ICBM test, and we were testing two things. How did stealth technology work? And how did the Challenger surveillance technology work, the shuttle? Both our key spy satellite in that area was looping over the path of the KL-007 flight, as was the shuttle. The Soviet defenses were lit up and exposed. The plane, I believe, stayed on course on R-20 until it got beyond Noka Point over the Kuril Trench. At that point, Soviet interceptors were attempting to catch the similarly made Boeing smaller Ferret plane, which was the stealth technology plane flowing from Anchorage. That plane does regular figure eight loops from Anchorage out near the R-20 line. They brought it up simultaneous with the commercial flight, melded the radar signals, and then it took off as a stealth plane into the Soviet airspace. At some points, it made enough radar noise, or intentionally or not, to bring up Soviet interceptors. The first time they came up, they couldn't find it. Well, when you have modern radar technology on the ground on a plane, you can find a bogey. You can find something that's up there. So this was blocking them. At the later point when they came up, I believe that it was orchestrated for them to get close enough to think they were firing at something, but the part of stealth is deflection of even the firing mechanism and the heat-seeking missiles, radar technology. So the pilot went and said, target is destroyed. What he means by that is not that he fired a missile and then kept flying along with the missile to see if the missile hit the other plane. Once you let that missile go, you veer off, both because you can get return fire and because you don't want to be in part of the explosion. And so they backed off at that point, but when CIA and Defense Intelligence listeners in Japan heard the Soviet pilot say the target is destroyed, they simultaneously detonated a bomb on board KL-007, blew it up over the Kuril Trench, one of the deepest areas of the ocean there, and the plane remains were never found. This had multiple purposes. It allowed the evil empire myth to renew the Cold War status at a point when we were reaching detente. It backed up the Kirkpatrick Doctrine in the United Nations. North and Gene Kirkpatrick worked together on doctoring the phony pilot tapes that would be played to the public in the United Nations. It put a cut to put a stop to a 30% Pentagon funding cut that month. It promoted Star Wars and stealth. It allowed the Pentagon to keep experimenting with nerve gas and doing nuclear testing, which we're about to be interfered with, and continued the Cold War. At Boeing, which created both these planes, Scoop Jackson was on the board, and the day of the 007 flight, he dropped dead. Mr. Secord had used these KAL planes to deliver the Contra arms. The specific pilot in this KAL plane was a Korean CIA pilot for the president of Korea and for Bo Hee Pak, the head of the intelligence agencies there. And I believe that when Jackson was taken out simultaneously. Haig went in to take his place on the Boeing board. Henry Kissinger took his place on the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, the Central American section. Spitz Channel, a fundraiser for Oliver North, replaced Larry McDonald, the right-wing fanatic from Western Goals, who I don't believe actually died in his life and got off in Anchorage and someday will emerge from the gulag of the Soviet Empire, at least according to the propaganda story, and this is the line that's being pushed since that time by the John Birch Society. But McDonald had to go deep cover because Meese was replacing William French Smith in the Justice Department at that point, and French left to help cover up the whole California Watergate West scandal that might have threatened Nixon going back into office. So there were a number of things being done, and like many of these intelligence scenarios, it was written 2 years before in a book called Flight 209 is Down by Barry Schiff, who's an aviation magazine writer, and he outlined exactly this kind of scenario where a stealth plane is tested and the real plane is blown up. He has the congressperson on the plane getting blown up, but it's a thinly disguised version of Scoop Jackson. I think that Bush and Oliver North set up the whole Contragate scandal, and I think that in fact it was Mr. Bush that signed the finding that began the whole shipment of arms. I think they knew what they wanted to do, and I think they had the Tower Commission come in and cover it up. And Tower wanted in return to get position Secretary of Defense. He was unable to. Got angry, wrote a book about it, and now he's dead. But at the time, I think that the Tower Commission was covering for them. And the early testimony by Meese and McFarland and the other operatives, all of them give the same day there in July 1985 as the date that they remember the presidential finding authorizing arms to Iran being signed. And I went back into my clippings to find that day in my Reagan file, and that's the day that Reagan had prostate surgery. And because they were afraid he was going to die and it might be another crisis management problem, they officially made Bush president for 8 hours that day, and I think Bush, as president, signed the finding. I don't think he told Reagan, after all, he might mention it. I mean, they didn't wake him up for the war, so why bother him with this little detail? And I think Reagan, in fact, can't remember because he didn't know and didn't do it. That will be my only defense of this evening. But I think that Bush, in fact, set it up and orchestrated. Mr. Tower was married into the Cummings family, which is huge money and part of the JFK scandal and assassination. Cummings ran InterArm Co., one of the largest arms dealers in the world, used by the CIA and by Oliver North. InterArm Co., in fact, sold the batch of Mannlicher Carcanos to Klein Sporting Good in Chicago, who then were supposed to have shipped one of these Mannlichers to Lee Harvey Oswald's P.O. box, all of which was phony, but the Tower was also involved in the TFX scandal during the JFK years, which involved General Dynamics and Fred Cort, who had handled Oswald's father's divorce from his mother. Cort was, in fact, probably the guy that recruited Oswald into Navy intelligence at that time and helped to set him up over those years as an intelligence operative. But I think that North coming out and saying he was going to take the fall, it wasn't much of a fall and it didn't hurt. After his performance, they retained him in the Marine Corps and put him in charge of something called Corps 2018, which would plan all the wars for the next 30 years. And so he did that, and he briefed all of the Marine generals on how to create second and special filing devices that would hide their operations from any future congressional scrutiny. There's a new book out just recently on these special filing techniques perfected by J. Edgar Hoover called The Secret Files of J. Edgar Hoover by Mr. Theo Harris. And then there was the phony investigation of Contragate done by the people who were involved. They said they had an article in the Washington Post, and they said, how do they choose the lawyers to head up these investigative teams that go into these big scandals? And they said, well, there's a batch of about 20 lawyers that are specialists in this, and they just picked from those few. And I thought it was just coincidence that the same lawyers kept showing up, but apparently they plan it. And they came in and they said, there's no conflict of interest here. And I said, that's right. If there was a conflict of interest, you wouldn't be the lawyer. It's the same interest, you see. Like you have this whole team, von Goldschwing, who was Eichmann's superior, working with Reinhard Gehlen. When Gehlen goes back to Germany to form German intelligence, he puts von Goldschwing in charge of the CIA here. And then Helena von Damm, at that point, leaves von Goldschwing and goes to Reagan. And when they came here in the 50s, von Goldschwing set up a corporate front called TCI, Transnational Computer Investments. And among his illustrious early board and investors were Helena von Damm, Edwin Wilson, and Frank Turkle. They got other people along the way, Emanuel Fotnakis from the Greek fascists after that, Hunta took over. But they ran this nice little company and covered up their international CIA operations for many years. Who do you think drew up the corporation papers for TCI in California in 1956? Mr. Arthur Lyman, the head investigator of the Contragate scandal. Mr. Neals, another one who asked all the tough questions, had worked on the Koreagate scandal, which is really the CIA in Korea, bribing people back here, pretending the KCIA is not CIA. But Neals worked on that scandal along with who? Leon Jaworski, our old Nazi mover. And the special prosecutor, still working hard, is Mr. Welch. But Mr. Welch said the thing about conflict of interest himself, because someone asked him whether he thought it was proper that it was his law firm that drew up the actual transfer contracts for Southern Air Transport to ship the arms down to the Contras. No conflict of interest there. Boxes are in the coop. Thomas Polgar, another congressional investigator, comes in. He had replaced Theodore Shackley in Vietnam and Laos for the running of the opium out of that sector and the covert operations in the war. So they get him because he knows a lot about the situation. He's a good investigator. And they just come over from Operation Phoenix, Air America, and the dope smuggling in those years. So you have these little teams that move. Shackley, Kleins, North, Polgar, Greg linked to Rodriguez, and then he's National Security Advisor to Bush when he comes in. And Carter names Greg as, Jim Carter names Greg as the key suspect in the October surprise operation. You have another team around Hague involving Frank Carlucci and Mr. Schultz and Weinberger. They move in and out of these different government departments. They're at the Office of Management Budget, and they go to Health, Education, Welfare. Then they go work at Bechtel. And then they come back in as the Secretary of Defense, the Defense Department. I mean, the government is so generic in the United States, you can just be anything. You know, you can be Secretary of Defense 1 month, then you can be Education, Welfare the next month. You don't need any special expertise because all you're doing is standing up there in your suit while the thugs around the world and pay you to look good. This is my beef with Bill Moyer's secret government tape, if any of you have seen that. He says that we have this legitimate government in the White House, but in order to get some dirty jobs done once in a while, they go out and they hire these bad elements, which they really shouldn't do, and these bad elements get them into trouble and into scandals, and they really just ought to stop doing that. I say those bad elements, the killers, the gun runners, the drug runners, are the government. And they in turn go out and hire the PR boys and the three suit boys and the dummies who wave their hat in front of you and make you think you've got a government. So Hague was actually the company commander at West Point for Mr. Secord. Secord, Shackley, and Kleins interrelate through a corporate firm called EATSCO, Egyptian Arms Transfer, which also involved Wilson and Turkle. And then eventually, the old TCI firm in the 1970s, von Goldschwing's front, decided it was going into bankruptcy, started to fold, and it sold off its largest subsidiary corporation, International Imaging Systems. Who did it sell it to? An individual by the name of Hakim. Our team renamed it Stanford Technology Training Group International, the enterprise of Oliver North and the Congregate people. If the thing works, why not just keep moving it down through history? Now we have Mr. Fierce coming out saying that maybe Bush's current appointment for the head of the CIA, Mr. Gates, knew more than he's willing to admit about the Congregate scandal, not to mention what else. And it's so obvious, since he put Gates up before and he was turned down, that there might be somebody waiting in the wings, so that the Congress sort of shoots its energy getting rid of Gates so that the real CIA head can come in without much opposition. So we should wait and see who's behind him. But the National Security Council under Bush, William Clark came over from the Pentagon, brought in Dick Allen and Donald Gregg, and they in turn then run the schlepper level of the guys that carry the guns and the drugs and do the killing. And these plans go all the way back to the beginning of Bush's administration. They interlink the U.S. CIA and the Israeli Mossad in the arms dealing with the Contras and other operations. And they have different things. They have Operation Tipped Kettle under Casey to involve the early Israeli arms shipments. And they have operations in Panama, Honduras, and El Salvador to cross-ship the guns, and what they call the Pink Team Plan. All these are right at the beginning of the Bush administration, but they don't get up to the level of a presidential finding that Bush can sign. This new scandal that's breaking of the BCCI, I think, is going to be yet another window into these networks, and if you're not clipping already on that scandal, you ought to be. This is the current Nugan Hand Bank, I think. Nugan Hand was formed in Australia in 1973 by Mr. Nugan and Mr. Hand, a CIA Green Beret operative that had been with the Phoenix kill teams in Vietnam, worked involved with Wayne Colby. Wayne Colby was tied to this bank, as well as numerous other military intelligence and Vietnam-era operatives. Its main purpose, set up all around the world, was to launder the money that was carrying the opium out of the Golden Triangle in Southeast Asia at the end of the war into other places around the world. And it operated in much the same way before it folded and people died and disappeared, as the BCCI apparently is. Bank of Credit and Commerce International, which Mr. Gates apparently made a joke about calling it the Bank of Crooks and Criminals, you ought to know, and what economists just recently called the BCCIA, which is probably the proper term for it. The CIA wants us to believe that they just kept a hand in there so they could catch the really big fish. Sometimes they'll look in the mirror and see who the fish are. But it involves a lot of people in 69 countries. The Jordanian army had accounts there. General Zia, fascist ruler there in Pakistan, involved the Pakistani opium money, as well as guns for the Afghanistan rebels, and Miami drug laundering accounts, even involving Rajiv Gandhi, who was recently assassinated, Abu Nidal, the terrible terrorist that Oliver North is so afraid of, he built a fence around his house, he said, so that Abu Nidal wouldn't come in and get him. I call him Abu Iman. But Abu Nidal had 42 different accounts with BCCI, and tens of millions of dollars went through the bank. Of course, interestingly enough, so did the money for funding the Contras and Oliver North's operations. And it's not the first connection I've found between Abu Nidal's funding and Mr. North. If he wanted to have a mano with Abu Nidal, I think he would have invited him over for dinner. That fence is up there in case we figure out what he's doing. They had this, what they call a black network, 1,500 people involved. One of the agents surfaced recently. They call him Mustafa. And this is basically a strong-arm network for the bank. CIA and the DIA had accounts. They said they're just routine. For their international operations. They drug laundered in Tampa. A credit line was extended, and $50,000 retainer was paid to Andrew Young in order to introduce the bank owners to third world leaders. And Young played, I believe, a very sinister role in the assassination of Martin Luther King years before, and also worked with CIA in Africa, carrying out their plans for corporatization of Africa. And more recently, he said he would like to have the Guatemalan police brought up to Atlanta, where he is in government, so that they could be trained by the Atlanta police. And he's also indicated that he'd like to become head of the CIA. Maybe that's who's behind Gates and the bro. Even Perez de Cuellar, the UN head, was provided free plane flights by this bank. They apparently were trying to get influence wherever they could. President Peru has indicated several other banks. Mrs. Budo's family, who took over from Zia in Pakistan, apparently lost $10 million in the London bank. Manuel Noriega and Saddam Hussein did their banking there. And the bank even gave $8 million to the Jimmy Carter Center in Atlanta as a philanthropic gift through one of their fronts. The banks under them include First American Bank shares in D.C., which compromises Clark Clifford and Robert Altman in the investigation, the Independence Bank in Mendocino, California, and First American Currency in Laguna Hills, and American Southern Insurance Corporation is owned by them. I guess you're standing and says America or First, and you better hold on to your money. And SunTrust Savings in Florida, which was implicated in this laundering. And so you have this central area. Even Ben Banerjee, is the Irangate arms dealer from India, apparently was using the bank. And the Medellin cartel, cocaine money, was being funneled through it. People who were running arms to Hussein in Argentina, to Falklands, were involved in the Pakistani branch, and the Islamic Jihad, which is supposedly holding the hostages, they had an account. Ferdinand Marcos had an account. Adnan Khashoggi had an account, another big CIA arms dealer. And they apparently handed all of this niceness off to, well, also somebody now has come out, Inam ul Haq, who apparently was setting up funding to transport nuclear arms technology to a lot of third world countries through this bank. And now 77% of the ownership is under this Sheikh Zayed, one of the oil emirates and rich people in the world. And he's sort of holding the bag and are waiting breathlessly to find out if he's just going to take the money and run or pay back some of the depositors. Even Adolfo Calero, the head of the contract operations, was using this bank. And the governments have known about it for some time, and Mossad and other international intelligence agencies were working through it as well. The DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, had a slush fund for clandestine activities, but when the Justice Department was approached from time to time with these pieces of information, even about Noriega, they would not move on it. And now someone surfaced as Mr. Von Raab at the Customs Department, who said he talked to Gates in 1986 about BCCI, and I noticed in a radio report this week that Von Raab's wife, who was a loans manager at First American Bank Shares, the Clifford firm, was let go by Robert Altman, so maybe that's really what started the scandal, is that they fired his wife. But regardless of how it breaks, this is part of a long pattern of banking for covert operation interests. Several books that I think you should get if you don't have them or haven't read them are Hot Money by R.T. Naylor from up here in Canada. In Banks We Trust by Penny Larnoux, and Inside Job by three individuals who did States who did extensive work on the SNL scandals and their links. The CIA has had banks do its dirty work for a long time. Paul Helliwell, one of the early OSS and CIA operatives in Southeast Asia, set up in the Bahamas the Castle Bank and Trust. I mentioned the Nugenham Bank. There's many other banks that have served both for mafia and CIA purposes to do this kind of money laundering. And some of them, of course, as you may know, involve the Bush family. Prescott Bush Jr. Is George's brother, was just recently linked to a purchase of a Tokyo bank that tied directly in its corporate ownership and board of directors to organized crime there in Japan. Another one, the Knights of Malta. This is the brother. And the last night of the debates between Bush and Carter, Bush said, "I have unleashed the Bush family on America." And I knew what he meant. His son, George W. Bush, is a general partner in the Texas Rangers baseball team. He also, though, owns Harkin Energy Corporation in Dallas, which had $8 million in revenue in 1986, and merged then with, it was a small company, and merged with his Spectrum 7 Exploration Corporation, and he took over Harkin. And just in a short period of time, he moved to Dallas, went on as a consultant to the CEO at $120,000 a year, and by 1990, 4 years later, they had a $1.1 billion revenue, 19 states they had oil and gas reserves, and right now this firm has the exclusive oil concession to the island of Bahrain for all exploration and transport and purchase of oil or gas out of Bahrain, which accounts for 1/6 of the total reserves in that area. So Bush's son has a little bit of financial interest in what happens in Kuwait, since Bahrain is an island right off the shore there. His son Jeb Bush had extensive ties with the Miami drug dealers, the inventor of the cigarette boats and the Contra operations. And his son Neil Bush, who I mentioned earlier, in connection with Standard Oil and the Hinckley ties, also played a strange role, according to Rolling Stone magazine, after Siaga was put into power by the CIA in Jamaica. It was Siaga men, his goons, that came to a concert of reggae and political rock star Bob Marley and shot at Marley and wounded him. And Marley went up into a mountain retreat there in Jamaica and was nursing his wounds and trying to recover from the situation. And someone showed up at the door from Rolling Stone magazine. A reporter who wanted to write about the incident spent several days there. And then right after that, Marley took a flight to Europe and checked in at hospitals there and was found to have a massive brain tumor, cancerous brain tumor, which killed him in a short period of time. Cancers of this sort have been and can be introduced from outside artificially. It happened in many cases, including Martin Mitchell and Jack Ruby, different melanomas. These were things that the Nazis studied, or Fort Dietrich studied for many years, and came to light in a Rolling Stone magazine article. Didn't know what was happening, that the person who had impersonated one of their reporters, in fact, didn't work for them, and was Neil Bush. Now, what's Neil Bush doing with Bob Marley at his house a few days before he dies of a massive brain tumor? I guess we're supposed to believe he's got an extensive interest in reggae music. This is the Bush family, and it's Neil Bush also who, of course, is tied into this scandal with the Silverado saving loan out in California, being referred to now as rip-off saving loan, one of the many that pulled it, but also had ties that through its loans to Herman Beebe Sr. and Carlos Marcello and Mr. Gambino, the Mafia, and Trafficante, and eventually back to Paul Helliwell and these others. So there's a whole scandal of involvement of both CIA and Mafia being in these SNL drains and foldings that's being brought out by Pete Bruton from the Houston Post. And then more recently, Mr. Bush brings us into the oil war, and he says, this time we won't be fighting with one hand tied behind our back like the Vietnam War. But with the level of genocide that went on in Vietnam and the millions of craters that destroyed the rice capital of the world, now imports all of its rice, I don't know which hand was tied behind the back. I mean, I didn't see the United States backing off at all, except in 1954 when Richard Nixon went to Eisenhower and asked him to drop nuclear bombs in order to save the French there and the French rule, and similar plans that were stated by General LeMay and some of the right-wing diplomat back in the Stone Age of used nuclear weapons. I don't think anything much worse could have been done to Vietnam or the United States, but Bush wants us to think that we had a hand tied behind our back, and I think it has to be that nuclear hand and near-nuclear weapons of current technology, no radiation, but as destructive as nuclear weapons, were tested extensively for the first time in the war against Iraq. And they caused massive genocide there. We manipulated the news about them in the United States, and so people don't understand the level of destruction that went on. An Australian peace team that went in heard of these butterfly and toy bombs being used there. Children in the hospitals in Iraq had their hands or parts of their limbs or feet blown off by these little bombs. They were used during Vietnam as well in the United States. They look like a toy, they're bright colors, and children tend to pick them up or go over near them, and then they explode. And they're specifically anti-personnel weapons, as were the cluster bomb units. These huge bombs that drop down to a certain altitude, pop open, out come all these little balls, air lines that spin through the air in different directions, spread out, and they explode. Inside those are tinier flechettes or ball bearings. Now, these won't puncture a tire, a truck, or even go through a sandbag, but they penetrate, they're designed to penetrate human flesh. They used them in Vietnam, and the Vietnamese got good at surgically removing the ones in the veins and saving lives, and so at that point, Honeywell, American Corporation was producing them, went to plastic versions so that they couldn't be seen by the X-ray. According to a report by a Harvard medical team, at least 170,000 more children will die. And in fact, the U.S., the Red Cross International said that it might be as many as into the millions of people are going to die because they bombed the whole infrastructure of that society. They went for every water deposit, every electric generator, every aspect of the society that could function to preserve a normal human existence after the war. And so it was like in Vietnam, a very genocidal war, a war of total deception where they used decoys and disinformation, especially back across with the ground troops. And the people planning this call themselves the Jedi Knights. They're at the central command of the Army Concept and Doctrine Directorate. Mr. John Kane, Lieutenant Colonel Tolliver are the names, and they're the General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, and they train the officers in these techniques, and then they lie to the press. Sununu told on August the 8th, told the press that this was defensive only in Saudi Arabia and that 50,000 troops were moving. In fact, it was 250,000. Bush secretly was telling CIA to overthrow Hussein on August the 15th, and they were already planning for 100,000 Iraqi dead from their bombings at that point. My mother did this planning for the Pentagon for American casualties in wars as a manpower analyst for 30 years for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. 5 levels above top security, she would determine the overall draft call. And she'd do that by taking a current force level, a force level 5 years down the pike that the Pentagon wanted, and she'd project how many would retire, how many would reenlist, how many would discharge under each category, and given the war scenarios they had laid out, how many would die, and therefore how many did you have to enlist and draft in order to keep it at the levels they wanted. And she had to be right on annual national calls within 100 people either way. I asked her, after she retired, when did they tell you they would escalate in Vietnam? She had to be among the first to know. She said, late November of 63. I said, the last week of November? She said, yes. The Monday following the Kennedy assassination. I said, was this a massive escalation? Additional troops or advisors? What was the situation? She said, I couldn't believe the figures. I took them back to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and I said, these can't be right. And they said, those are the figures, and you'll use them. This is November 25th, 1963, they told my mother, the Pentagon, that the war in Vietnam would last for 10 years and that 57,000 Americans would die in that war. Exactly on target. They knew where they were going then. They know now what they're taking us into. And we exist in a world where we don't even have a media that can tell us what's happening in another country, much less when the country's under war and the most important time to know. They called it the biggest goddamn defensive since World War II, which is probably an appropriate term if you're religious. And they used the media basically as cheerleaders and part of the deception program. And they planted false stories in order to confuse both us and the Iraqis. And these are the same people that really put Saddam Hussein into power, our CIA that helped him and his Ba'ath Party get into office there in order to manipulate politics against a progressive or open rule or nationalization of the resources we hear so much anywhere around the world. And we gave them a green light to the State Department and other contacts to go ahead into Kuwait. Kuwait had bought a slant drilling company in Houston that perfected a technique that would drill sideways through the ground And so they dipped across the border into the southern edge of the Rumaya oil fields in Iraq and siphoned off $14 billion worth of oil in 1 year, and then sold the oil, undercut the OPEC prices, and undersold it, and shipped it out. And there were constant complaints from Saddam Hussein's government. They complained to Bush about it. And the word back from Bush was, these are internal matters between your government and Kuwait. United States has no defense treaty with Kuwait. This is your business to do as you will, because they wanted to trigger the situation that could reestablish total control of the Middle East and a permanent U.S. military presence in that area. And that's why the United States went in. The United States was in no danger of running out of oil. Kuwait accounted for 6% of our imported oil, which only accounts for 25% of our overall oil use at the current time. There's plenty of oil in the world. We were worried because that oil goes not to us, but to Japan and Germany, the two main competitors in the current capitalist world. They were compromised. They have no internal oil source. They were compromised in this way by the setup of OPEC, the Rockefeller family, and forced into the Trilateral Commission, which is the New World Axis for world hegemony, some years ago. And just so they get the message, now nobody's getting any oil. Tremendous fires going on at all the oil wells, which I believe we're, United States, responsible for and planned, and ruin the ecology there and around the world in many respects. But we're not allowed to see that. Kuwait was set up like a line in the sand by the British in order to thwart the Ottoman Empire, to drive a wedge there and get control of the sea lanes around the Gulf. And if you can look at any map, you can see it's artificially drawn a little wedge that keeps Iraq from getting down easily to the Gulf Sea transport. And for many, many years, there were attempts by the government of Kuwait to reestablish its ties with Iraq and become again part of the Basra province in that area. All that was ignored. Popular movements in that regard were ignored. The bankrupt and fascistic family, the Spa family there in Kuwait, was kept in power by the United States. And eventually matters came to a head. And then Bush suddenly takes up a matter of principle, which doesn't seem to be a principle anywhere we invade around the rest of the world. But we can't let anybody else do it because they're showing us up, I guess. So there's several books that have been out about this. They're important. Arab Reach by Hogue Lewin is one of the report developed about the whole situation in the Middle East. But it's, he says in that book that huge petrochemical cities were being developed in Kuwait since some period of 1980s, early 1980s, early 83. And the point was they would have these petroleum cities and they would produce not only oil, but petroleum byproduct and plastic and become the main world exporters of plastic, and they would be able to have nearly slave, very cheap, expendable labor to run these huge operations, and that was set up down there for these oil companies. And I think that now they're in a position to go ahead with it. I think Hussein was really never a serious target of the United States, but we get certain advantages by going into a war. We get to test weapons and make profits. You get a certain level of social manipulation and control from it, and it blocks off oil in other areas. But the cost of that is this tremendous human damage that's done to the people in the country. I'm saying somebody today, our view seems to be such a terrible dictator that we're going to wipe out everybody under his thumb. And that seems to be the rationale. And this was planned a long time. For the last 5 years, U.S. troops have been doing desert warfare training, and we finally got the Soviet Union on its knees. They're not going to interfere, and so the whole world is up for grabs for this machinery right now. To give you an idea of who was sent in there, in the 1920s, there was a West Point graduate being groomed for the ruling class by the World War I Prussian army and military training that was being given West Point in those years, named Norman Schwarzkopf Sr. And this is General Schwarzkopf's father. In the 1930s, he was nationally popular as the host of the Gangbusters radio show. By 1932, he was in the New Jersey State Police as a commissioner, and he was a disciplinarian there. They said he ran like a military camp. And he was responsible for heading up the so-called investigation of the Lindbergh baby kidnapping, in which he framed Bruno Hauptmann, a carpenter, who had no motive, in order to get national attention. Lindbergh was chosen by Adolf Hitler in the 1930s to be the President of the United States after Nazi rule was established here. In the 1940s, Schwarzkopf gets into a position of being sent back out to the world on behalf of President Roosevelt. President Roosevelt got a request from the young boy then, the Shah of Iran, to help protect the oil and his government there. And so Schwarzkopf was handpicked by Roosevelt to go out and help to train the Iranian police to back him up. That translates into Schwarzkopf's father trained Sabah, the deadly police force of the fascist killers there. And at the time, there in the early 40s, they also were very aware of the Daman Dome in Saudi Arabia, which was this tremendously huge oil deposit they had discovered at the end of the 1930s. They weren't tapping it very much. Oil became an important commodity during World War II. And Averell Harriman, Bush's father's old classmate, suggested to Roosevelt that they go in there and make sure the British weren't able to spread themselves out to those areas of their control during the war and make sure that that oil didn't get into the wrong hands. And in 1943, they set out along with Floyd Ollinger, who later was to found Aramco, Arab American Oil Company, and some Standard Oil people, an oil refinery that was pumping out hundreds of millions of barrels of oil through pipelines across the desert there down into Haifa through certain other routes. And in 1943, when they set this up, they put 30,000 U.S. troops around that oil refinery to protect it, and the general in command of those troops was Norman Schwarzkopf Sr. In 1946, following his World War II duty, he was set up and established as the provost marshal for the military rule of Germany under General Lucien Clay, which puts him directly in contact with the 919th Counterintelligence Corps, the beginnings of the Ratline, and eventually John J. McCloy, and the pardoning of the key Nazis. In 1951, still useful, he was traveling in the Middle East, and especially in Iran, and in those years began to work with a CIA operative who still works there by the name of Bruce O'Dell. And O'Dell and Schwarzkopf worked on behalf of the CIA to put a pro-Nazi, pro-fascist element into power in Iran. And Mossadegh won the popular election instead. So in 1953, Bruce O'Dell, Schwarzkopf's father, and Kermit Roosevelt, who later sat on the board of Standard Oil, were instrumental in the CIA plot to overthrow Mossadegh and put the Shah of Iran back on the throne, lest the oil be nationalized. So the son is a West Point graduate as well, following in his footsteps. He brings it in the 1980s to Grenada and the invasion of Panama. He was a Vietnam commander as well, and part of the cover-up of the friendly fire that killed U.S. troops there. And he was a top planner for these recent invasions in the Iraqi war. And he brought forward the lessons that they learned in Vietnam, and now has reached a hero status of some kind within the United States. The New World Order that Bush and these elements want to bring in includes the tremendous concentration of wealth and technology that's happened in the Ruhr Valley in the 30s in Germany, a population and labor force that is currently seen as expendable, the end of civil and constitutional liberties and rights as we know them, tremendous carnage and terror around the world by the wars that will follow in the establishment of police states and open martial law here in North America. You beat us, I guess, to at least an example of martial law up here. You had the first one, but we've got the permanent one down below the border. And a worldwide genocide that will eventually take out between 60 and 80% of the planet if it's allowed to continue. The agenda for this New World Order and for the end of this era up to the year 2000 is first a tight stranglehold on all the known resources of the world, and they're all known now with satellite technology, and either exploitation of local labor in order to bring that out, or genocide of that labor and mechanized and technology coming in to do it instead. A first strike capability with Star Wars, the MX missiles, the bombers, and the huge submarines that they want to put out in the ocean. So they'll have first nuclear strike capability, and they talk about something called Airland Battle 2000, which is full-scale chemical, biological, and nuclear attack on the Soviet Union by the turn of the century. Or the other element, which Bush is aligned with, will settle for Alan Dulles' dream of 1954 being realized, the destabilization of Eastern Europe, the final fall of the communist rule in the Soviet Union, so that it itself could be exploited, tremendous labor resources, oil and timber, and other resources. This is their version. This is who really runs America. The reason they put this kind of energy into running America is to cover up the biggest secret of all. The biggest secret of all is that who runs America is us. And once we get onto this game, once we realize this gig, and withdraw our sanction and our support, and say no, they're finished.